If somebody could find my lost committee administrator and send him to up here, that would be nice. All right, we're going to call the meeting to order. This is a meeting of the Subcommittee on Corrections. It's an extra meeting. Would like to thank all the members for making time in their schedule to get here. We do have a lot of overlapping committees at this point, so some of the folks that would have liked to have been here are not here. Representative Tathke, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and move that we accept the minutes.
Okay. Any questions, corrections? Okay, all those in favor of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
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 Okay, the minutes are approved. All right, we have three bills that we are going to hear today. And let's start off with our esteemed Majority Leader, Representative Winkler. Do you have testifiers that you...
Mr. Chair, there are testifiers. Up here, do we need this microphone? I don't want us to.
I would assume you would do.
Yeah, let's.
Let's pick it up somehow for the SLR here. It is?
Okay, but let's take that over there just in case. If somebody would grab that and give it to. Nice call or catch. Majority.
Try to have open meetings, Mr. Chair.
But I'm all in favor of it. Love them. That's why we went to Stillwater. Proceed.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can't move the bill.
You're not a member.
I'm not a member of this committee.
Allow me. I would like to move the bill to be held over for the omnibus.
Okay. Mr. Chair, House File 1237, bans private prisons in the state of Minnesota. Our criminal justice system is a core responsibility of government. Minnesotans deserve strong public safety, and private prison companies fail to deliver on that. Prison corporations put their profits ahead of public safety and are more dangerous for inmates and staff. The bill moving forward in the House File 1237, will ensure that private prisons cannot operate in Minnesota. And Mr. Chair, there are countless examples of this around the country, the challenges that private prisons face in terms of safety, outcomes, and the simple fact of the matter is that they have the wrong incentive in the system. The incentive is based on profit. It is not based on correction or rehabilitation or reintegration. And to the degree that safety is a priority, their record is not very strong. While we understand the need for additional corrections officers and space, and certainly the people testifying on behalf of this bill today can tell us a lot more about that, at the core, this is a question of whether or not it is even legitimate for people to be incarcerated in the state of Minnesota if it is not done by a public entity. I believe that it is a core function of government and only should be done by government, and it should be done by employees accountable to the public. And so, Mr. Chair, with that brief introduction, I think I would ask testifiers to come forward.
Testifiers, please. State your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the board. My name is Anna Cookton, and I'm a sergeant at the Correctional Facility for Shakopee for Women. I am also the vice president of AFSCME Local 1988, a secretary for the Corrections Policy Committee, and an AFSCME Council 5 executive board member. We've heard terrible things about what happened in the private prisons, from offenders not receiving medical care and dying, women not receiving prenatal care and having children when it shouldn't, before their time is. And we've heard of rape, corrupt staff, just to mention a few. But rather than focus on why private prisons are bad, I'd like to tell you why the state prisons are good and why we should keep them as state-operated prisons. So when people ask me about prison and what happens and what it's like, I often tell them it's like a little city. Anything you need to run a little city, we need to run for our prisons. We need chaplains, we need teachers, we need medical staff, we need mental health staff, staff for treatment, and of course you need security like me. As a corrections officer, my responsibility is to make sure that my coworkers are safe, the public is safe, and offenders are safe. I take that job very seriously, and so does everybody in this room. We're a family. At the end of the day, we all want to go home safe. And most people assume that we as corrections officers are only there to enforce the rules, to make sure it's safe. However, and that is a big function of our job. Without rules and structure, our facilities aren't safe. Rules and structure are good things, especially for those who may have not had it in their lives up until this point. Rules and structures give guidelines for how we do things. But as CEOs, we're there more often than any other staff. We're there with the offenders in their worst times. Maybe they've lost a family member. We're there in their best times. Maybe they've had a grandkid, and they want to share all about it because that's really exciting news. So as a CEO, I have the chance to teach people. I set an example of how to handle a situation maybe where they would have handled it differently in the past. I had an offender once tell me that she was really excited to have a young female sergeant because it shows her what her life would have been like had she made other choices. That stuck with me. Now I work mostly with the public in the post that I have, and I still have the opportunity to teach, and I also enforce the rules because with anybody that comes into the facility, I have to make sure that it's the right person and they're not bringing anything in that would harm us in our facilities. But as I said, we're a little city. It's not just corrections officers, although we make up the bulk of the staff, and again, our job is to make sure we're safe. We have medical staff on grounds. A lot of the offenders we have medical issues. If for some reason we can't take care of it at the facility, we are close to hospitals, which is a big deal. In case something were to be bigger than what we can take care of, we can get people to where they need to be in a short amount of time. Also, programming is a very large part of what we do at state facilities, whether it's through jobs or groups. At Shakopee, we have opportunities for offenders to work with our maintenance staff, learn basic skills in fixing things, so when they get out, they're a little bit more capable of doing things that they maybe not have been able to do before. They learn how to paint and landscape, which provides jobs for them when they get out. Education is a big piece of what we do. For those that don't have a GED or high school diploma, we put them in school. For those that do, there's opportunities for college classes. One of my favorite programs that we have is the cosmetology program. It teaches the offenders a trade. Most of them get jobs when they get out, and so they're less likely to come back. It also gives the offenders a chance to feel like a human being for maybe an hour while they get their hair done, because everybody likes to feel good once in a while. At Shakopee, we focus a lot on parenting, as most of the offender mothers that get out will be leaving prison and will be the primary caregivers. But this is only the tip of the iceberg. We have volunteers that lead groups every day of the week. Programming, education, and jobs help the chances of offenders from coming back to prison. It also gives them a feeling of self-worth and accomplishment. But there aren't only opportunities for offenders. There's opportunities for staff. We go through yearly training, whether that's CPR or mental health, basics of stress. We also, as corrections officers, practice different security scenarios. We go through simulations of things we might have to deal with so that we're prepared when the time comes. We have opportunities to receive specialized training, whether that's a response team, negotiations, and I'm part of our crisis intervention team and de-escalation team. Most facilities also have an honor guard. As union employees, we have the ability to bargain for fair wages, benefits, and fight to keep a pension for when we retire. We are invested in what we do. We have to ask ourselves if private prisons would provide these same opportunities and services for staff and offenders. Historically, they haven't. When the bottom line is profit, why would you provide services to help keep offenders out? You'd want to keep them in so that you can keep your profits high. Why would you care if staff have ongoing training and pay wages and benefits that would cut into the profit? On a personal note, prison is already often a person's lowest point in their lives. I think it's immoral to keep people incarcerated for a profit. The effect that incarcerating people is bigger than just the person itself. It has ripple effects on families, children, and the economy that are far-reaching than most people ever think about. This is especially true for persons and families of color. Why would we want to fill more beds and take people out of these positions where they could be caring for their children, where they could be taking care of their parents as they get older, where they could be having jobs and supporting our economy and buying things from our state? Instead, they're sitting in prison. I can't work for a corporation that wants to just keep people in. That, is, to me, would just go against everything that I value as a person. And I don't think it's okay to make money off of people's misery. I ask that you support House File 1237. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak today.
Good job.
Next testifier. Rick, if you would state your name and position for the record, and if you would pull the microphone a little closer so that we can...
Perfect. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Rick Nyssen. Spelling on that is N-E-Y-S-S-E-N. I'm the AFSCME president of Local 599 at the Minnesota Correctional Facility in St. Cloud, where I'm a corrections sergeant. I'm also an executive board member of AFSCME Council 5. I've been working in the prison for 27 years, and I come before you to speak in support of House File 1237. The private prison industry continues to attempt to get a foothold in Minnesota, and this needs to stop, and I believe House File 1237 is vital to accomplish this. It's immoral for anyone to profit from human incarceration, as we've heard. Locking up people for profit has nothing to do with justice, and it has everything to do with making billions of dollars off of human misery. Let's be clear. The criminal justice is a core responsibility of government. As Representative Winkler said earlier, public workers should be protecting the public safety, period. You may wonder why I condemn private prisons. Of course, I don't want to work for a company that drives down my wages, benefits, and retirement security. But it's much more than protecting a good union job that provides for my family. My faith guides my work as a corrections officer, and it's not my job to judge or to punish anyone in my charge. I believe that will be taken care of way above my pay grade. Treating each other with respect and dignity is not just something we should do, it's something we must do. My coworkers take that approach every time they put on this uniform. I was taught three things as a young officer. I'm responsible for public safety, the safety of my coworkers, and the safety of the inmates that are in our charge. That's difficult to accomplish most days as it is. Imagine doing it with a CEO or a board of directors dictating your actions for their profit. All it takes is a Google search on private prisons and you can read for quite some time about the problems and pitfalls of entering into a relationship into this industry. Be it a federal judge closing down a management training corporation, Mississippi private prison, or the Tennessee legislature's bipartisan agreement that their contract with CoreCivic, which has rebranded its name from CCA, that it's a bad deal. It's the responsibility of the state of Minnesota not only to keep the public safe by separating dangerous people from society, but to provide an environment within these institutions that allow offenders to be at the very least not coming out worse than when they went in. When corporations are lobbying for stricter and longer sentences, and mark my words, if they get a foothold in Minnesota, they will be lobbying to keep people locked up longer. They are working towards keeping the cash flowing, not towards providing their charges with the tools to interrupt the cycle of prison stays or life skills to use on the outside. Cutting corners is their business model. We as a state need to keep working on sentencing reform bills to put less people in prison versus looking at getting into relationships with corporations whose sole purpose is to have as many people locked up as they can. Illinois, Iowa, New York all have laws on the books that look very similar to House File 1237. I've had the awesome opportunity to work for the AFSCME Racial, Social, and Economic Justice Work Group over the years. It's a national group of union members who are committed to speaking and acting on this country's challenges regarding the oppression of citizens based on race, economics, and social status. Mass incarceration is a byproduct of many of this country's issues relating to the racial, social, and economic equity. Entering into a private prison world would only make these matters worse. During the course of these meetings, I have had the opportunity to talk to fellow corrections professionals regarding private prison industry in their states. To a person, they highlighted not only the moral questions and problems with this practice, but also the financial burdens. The industry uses bait and switch to trap states. When they come in, the price tag is very inviting and it looks very good and everybody thinks that we're getting a deal. But once the state is in a position to no longer run a Department of Corrections, guess where that price tag goes? sky high. It is time for the state of Minnesota and the legislators who govern it to look into their conscience and make the decision to put the debate to run state for the state to run corrections versus private corporations to rest. The agreement to use the private prison model has only one underlying thread, and that's money. I support House File 1237, and I ask you to also. Thank you.
Thank you. Hold just for a moment. Representative Poston, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Majority Leader Winkler, do we currently have any private prisons in Minnesota?
An empty one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Poston, we have a facility in Appleton that could be used and has been used in that way, and we are trying to make sure that that does not happen again in the future.
Sure that it doesn't. Okay. How about, do we have any privately managed jails? Do local jails ever sub out that type of work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poston, I don't know whether there are privately managed jails. I would imagine that the answer to that question is no. But I don't, I don't have that information at my fingertips right now.
Thank you.
I'm sure somebody else could answer that for you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Jails are the privy of the local sheriff, and they just have virtually complete control over those, and I have yet to meet a sheriff that's willing to give that up.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
As I'm sure you know, within the bill is a prohibition of county sheriffs to house inmates in private jails, so I think that was probably the impetus behind the question.
You take care of it ahead of time, yes, good idea. Any other questions? Representative Tapke.
I have a general question about the bill. Do you want that now, or do you want to wait until
the testifiers? Let's wait until the end of the testifiers. Commissioner Snell, you're up next. Binder?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill today. I'm going to keep my comments very short to allow the people who actually do the work of corrections in Minnesota the opportunity to speak. First and foremost, as has been mentioned, I think it is a fundamental responsibility of government to provide for the public safety of its people, and corrections is part and parcel to that. I think as we look at the issue of private prisons, I think we have to remember the concept of build it and they will come. Economic theories around available capacity and motivation tell us that when expanded capacity or supply exists, we tend to think less critically about our policies. As a state, we have low levels of incarceration, while we maintain lower levels of crime overall when compared to other states. And this is something that we should be proud of. Minnesota DOC has a goal to reduce and even discontinue the use of double bunking. This goal should be achieved through the implementation of sound correctional practices, and not an increased capacity to house people in private prisons. I think it's also important that we make sure that the business model of prisons should be different than that of a restaurant, for instance. Those who own restaurants and similar businesses have an intrinsic motivation to keep customers coming back. Is this the right business model for our prisons? Minnesota does better than most, than many other states with recidivism reduction efforts, but we believe we still can do better. We believe it's possible to maintain public safety, achieve community and victim accountability interests, and have fewer people in our prisons. We, at the moment, are actively assessing a wide range of options and alternatives to achieve this goal. And the use of private interests or prisons do not support that goal. When governments are reliant upon private companies to provide for needed sources, the potential for a destructive dependency for bed space becomes possible. For-profit corporations could use that dependency as a leverage to negotiate higher compensation rates. A common negotiation, as was mentioned, is to begin to provide services and then make sure that we require additional costs for specialized services that are often needed by the inmate population. And finally, I think it's important that we remember that in 2016, the United States Department of Justice announced that it would begin to phase out the use of private prisons for federally based inmates. During the announcement, the DOJ noted that the reason for discontinuing the service was that for-profit prisons compared poorly to facilities that were operated by the government. They found that for-profit prisons provided fewer services that were needed by those housed in facilities. They had higher safety risk and higher security risk without producing substantial levels of savings. While there are studies that suggest in some instances that cost can be lower, that comes at a cost. And while it's true that some argue that the private sector can be incentivized to perform better, we have to ask the fundamental question, at what cost and by what measure? Given the reality that 95% of those in our prisons today will come back to communities across Minnesota, it's important that we do the best and provide for the best for those folks before they come back to our communities. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I ask you to stand in support of this bill.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions?
Thank you.
We have another testifier. You want to testify? Okay.
What's yours?
Okay. Your name and...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Richard Kajewski. I'm the Public Affairs and Communications Director for MAPE, and thank you to the men and women in uniform here today as well. MAPE employees make up many professional positions inside our correctional facilities, including nearly 400 psychologists, chaplains, caseworkers, therapists, and other programming staff. Our staff conducts sex offender and drug treatment programming, as well as mental health programming in the facilities. Our members take very seriously their role in reducing recidivism by promoting offender change through proven strategies during safe and secure incarceration and effective community supervision, the Department of Corrections mission. Chair members, we support House File 1237. It's a simple issue of safety and recidivism. While private prisons work to exploit states with budget concerns, studies show for-profit prison industry keeps offenders locked up longer to boast profits. They excessively hand up more infractions, lengthening offender sentences, and jeopardize staff safety, something we're very concerned about. Minnesota's Prairie Correctional Facility, despite cherry-picking its offenders, had a higher recidivism rate than DOC facilities, 13% higher for rearrest and 22% higher for reconviction. These higher recidivism rates will increase the costs of incarceration to the state of Minnesota, including in increasing victimization costs. Prairie Correctional Facility only accepted younger offenders without any serious medical conditions. Furthermore, they offered fewer programs than DOC facilities. I'd like to refer you to a study titled Comparing Private and Public Prison Services and Programs in Minnesota, Findings from Prisoner Interviews. It was published in the Criminal Justice Journal, Mr. Chair, out of the Sydney University School of Law, and they actually interviewed the offenders at the Prairie Correctional Facility as well as the Department of Corrections. And I'll read you just a piece on the treatment programs. The contract that a full-time had provided for a full-time intensive 6 hours per day, 5 days per week chemical dependency treatment program that would be in operation at the Prairie Correctional Facility and would be made available for at least 10% of the Minnesota inmates housed there. The program was to offer separate housing for the participants in a treatment regimen that would be cognitive and holistic along the lines of those available in the public system. The ratio of therapeutic staff to inmates was supposed to be at least 1 to 12. But once the contract commenced, the program failed to materialize. Mr. Chair and members, many of you have been on the Public Safety Committee before, and you know the value of treatment space in our correctional facilities, and I think that speaks volumes. So members, less programming, as we all know, for our younger offenders is not a recipe for safety in our institutions. Yet, with staffing being the highest cost of incarceration, followed by health care, there's only a couple of ways to save the taxpayers' money. Shorten staffing, which jeopardizes safety, cut programming, which jeopardizes safety, or contract only for the healthiest and well-behaved offenders. Opening a private facility in the future and determining and measuring their effectiveness will be challenging at best. Prisons must accept unhealthy inmates. those serving sentences for the most violent offenses, and must provide full programming focusing on preventing recidivism. Our own DOC facilities provide that. Our members pour their hearts and souls into their efforts demonstrated inside our public institutions every day. Keeping these facilities public will avoid so many of the problems you've heard today and will continue to hear in the future. Please support House File 1237. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Poston, you have a question?
Oh,
that's an old one. I'm sorry.
Okay.
We have another testifier, and has somebody who's been rather thin-skinned about having their name mispronounced. I'm not even going to try, if you would be so good.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Devika, and I appreciate your time. I know there's many people here with important things to say, so I'll keep it short.
Devika, we need your full name.
Devika Ghai.
Thank you.
Yeah. My name is Devika Ghai, and I'm here with an organization called Release Minnesota 8. Some of you might know. Release Minnesota 8 is a local organization. It was founded in 2016 and is led entirely by formerly incarcerated refugees and their family members. So as you know, and I should start by saying we are here to support House File 1237. As you know, immigrants, refugees, poor people, and people of color are much more likely to find themselves in the carceral system, often for petty crimes that people with more privilege simply get away with. I know this is not a popular thing to say, but it is factually correct that prisons and policing are an inherently racialized system. And private prisons are one of the largest profiteers in this system, making billions off of the backs of poor people and people of color. In 2012, private prison companies made over $5 billion incarcerating immigrants alone. People here have already shared many of the important data around human rights abuses in private facilities, so I won't repeat that. I just wanted to say that, knowing the data and knowing the track record of these facilities, and myself being an immigrant myself and having many friends and community members who have been through those systems in other states, I just wanted to say that allowing private prison companies, inviting them to do business in this state is sending a very direct message to the immigrant community, to our community, saying that we are not welcome here. So I hope in that context you'll support House File 1237 as we do. Thank you.
Thank you. That's the end of my list. Is there anyone from the public that would like to speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anyone. Just nice thing about being chair is you get to get the final word. I find private prisons to be did you have something, Representative? Go ahead.
Sorry, I don't want to step on your final word, Mr. Chair.
No, go ahead first.
I have a quick question about the bill here in line 1.17. For Representative Winkler, the line about not owned and operated by the state. In the past, the Shakopee Correction Facility has had to move inmates outstate and to other places because we didn't have the ability to house them any longer at the Shakopee Correctional Facility. And I'm just curious if this allows or does not allow the ability to send inmates to private prisons in other states if that becomes necessary. So I'm just curious as to what that is, and
Mr. Chair, Representative Tapke, as I read the language, it would not allow Shakopee to send prisoners outside to a facility owned by a different state, whether that public or private, and certainly not to a private institution in a different state.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author of the bill. Reading through the bill, it seems to not preclude what has been discussed a lot around here over the last several years, which is the acquisition by the state of Minnesota of a facility and the operation of that facility by state employee guards within it, buying a private facility and turning it into a state-owned and operated facility. That's been the legislative push for the last several years, and your bill does not, as I'm reading it, appear to stop that. Is that the author's intention, to still have it allowable for the Department of Corrections to purchase a currently private facility and operate it moving forward as a public facility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, it's my understanding that previous proposals have been to lease the facility and to operate it, and this would prohibit a lease. If the state were to acquire it, own it, run it, and essentially turn it into a fully public institution, it would not be precluded from doing so in this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler. That's the only way I would support such a matter going forward, is if it were owned and operated fully by state employees. I don't have any other questions.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for coming in late. As I let you know in advance, I did have a bill hearing.
Thank you for making it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I apologize if this has been asked already, but I'm just curious, is there any current plan by the state to do contracts with a private prison? Is that even on the table, or I'm just curious?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, we did briefly touch on that. I think the testimony of the commissioner today would indicate that there is no current plan to do so, and this bill would make sure that there is no future plan to do so either.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And again, thanks for making an effort to get here. I know you had conflicts. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to all of these folks. I know just from my district, I have about 45 people from the Stillwater Oak Park Heights area, and the jobs that they do help to keep us safe, and that's what this committee is all about. So thank you very much to all of you. There are some statistics I think that are important. The percentage, and I don't know it offhand, the percentage of folks in correctional facilities that have addiction problems, chemical dependency problems, is very, very high. And I think it's interesting to read that 42% of prisoners housed by the state receive chemical dependency programs, have access to chemical dependency programs. However, in private prisons, that is only 9.1%. And I think that says a lot about the goals and the objectives of private prisons. So I would like to bring that to light, and I support House File 1237. Thank you.
Anybody else on the committee wish to ask a question? I was just going to say, I think it's a disgusting business model that is predicated on people failing, and I find it disgusting. And again, when the Appleton facility was opened up, as I recall, shortly before they were due to start having people come in, they realized there was no sprinkler system. It was one of the shortcuts that they had taken. There were corridors where you couldn't get a wheelchair down, and there was, at that time, virtually no programming space. So, Majority Winkler, your last word.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, I thank you for your time and questions this morning. I also want to acknowledge and thank the corrections officers in this room today. We see what you do. We value your work. We value the contribution that you make to the public safety and to the betterment of the state of Minnesota. And this bill, I hope, will give you the confidence that the state of Minnesota fully supports the work that you do. And Mr. Chair, I would ask that your committee favorably consider House File 1237 for inclusion in your omnibus bill.
And I will renew my motion to hold the bill over for inclusion into the public safety omnibus bill. And thank you so much for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are we doing that? Okay. All right. Thank you. Next, we have me. Okay. Representative Wolgemuth.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. You had said that this was going to be part of the public safety omnibus bill. Are we doing a corrections omnibus division bill as well, or only the public safety bill?
It'll be rolled into the entire omnibus bill. It'll be a corrections, yes, and then it'll go in as a unit into the whole bill.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
you had just said public safety, so I just was curious. I thought we were going to do an omnibus or like a smaller mini omnibus bill of corrections, and then that would go to the Public Safety Committee?
Correct.
Thank you.
Sorry if I misstated it.
Okay.
Committee members, Mr. Chair, we will now hear a presentation on House File 1315, and I would like to make a motion to lay over the bill for possible consideration in the omnibus bill. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 1315 is also known as the Joseph Gom Bill, in memory of the young man that lost his life this past summer. Frankly, I'm hoping that this gives a little meaning for his family as we move forward. What was highlighted at that time was just how short we were in custody staff in the prisons. And then we had another tragedy shortly thereafter. It is a tight-knit community that affects actually not only the staff, but as we've heard, a lot of the inmates were also deeply affected by this and quite sorry about it. I would like to offer a shout out to AFSCME. They did a really good job going institution by institution, post by post within the within those institutions to come up with what is a number of guards. Custody staff, and I should go to residents too. I keep forgetting those things. The bill calls for 150 officers the first year, 60 the next year, 60 the next year, and 58 for a grand total of 328. Other than that, I guess I'll stand for questions. And would you like to say a few words?
I can. Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jeff Ars, Local 915 President at Oak Park Heights Prison. I just want to talk about the effects that we have on when we're low staff. First off, with the officers, you get forced sometimes going into the next shift. A lot of that can be coming off a midnight shift, working into a day shift, where at that point, because of your family structure, wherever that might be, now you have to look for alternative means for daycare or other issues like that. As I spoke about before and with several people here, it also affects the family life of events that are missed because of this. We do our events around our schedules, and a lot of times take place on our days off. And sometimes when you have something planned in the morning and all of a sudden you're forced into that, it can put stress on the household. I mean, it's understandable it might happen here or there, but with the addition of our programming that we've had, which is a good thing, our programming, but we've had to do it a little bit more lately, and that's the effect that we can have on the officers. As far as with the inmates, when you promise someone something, whether that's for them to get a phone call, get out for recreation, or some sort of programming, whether education, whatever that might be, and that can't run due to the fact that we're short-staffed to properly man that safely for the security of the institutions, it has a great effect on them too, and at times it can fall back on us of a lash out from someone else housed in that facility. If you guys have any questions or want me to elaborate anything, I'll feel free to do that.
Members, do we have any questions? Okay, seeing none. Yep, Representative Poston.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Chair Considine, can you just tell us how you arrived at this total number, and can you tell me, has a fiscal note been asked for?
There has been a fiscal note, and yes, I didn't bring the fiscal note. the number was, again, they went post by post in each institution and looked at what they thought was needed to conduct business in a safe manner. Again, if you're in the institution and you have, say, a medical emergency, that's going to take a minimum of two staff out of the rotation, and they're going to go to the hospital or the doctor with the offender. And so there are some staffs in there where you're not running constantly at the minimum. Just like to address that daycare thing, because I know for at least one custody officer, that means I get two 2-year-olds at 10 o'clock at night, or actually, in all fairness, it means my wife goes over there and spends the night, dang, they wear me out. Did I answer your question?
Yes, sir, thank you. Please state your name and what you represent for the record.
My name is John Hilliard. Good morning to Mr. Chair and the committee, and thank you for hearing us testify today. And the first thing I need to do, because I'd be remiss if I didn't, all the people sat behind us do a thankless job. They do it every day. They do it without prejudice, and they're very passionate about their job. And nobody has mentioned the canine officer that's here today, and we do have one canine officer here today, so I want to make sure we know that.
And he has his dog.
And, you know, what I want to talk about that's very important, the biggest program that we have is security. Without security, we could not do any of the programming that we have, whether it be education, psychology, the industry program, going out to recreation. Any programming we have and will have and create in the future, we need security to do it. We talk about the post that we have. The post is post to staff ratio, meaning how many posts we have, that's how many staffing we actually need. And at this point in time, we can't fill every post in that institution. It's very important that we do that, not only for the safety of the officers, but the safety of all other staff and the safety of the inmates. As the commissioner said, 95% of the offenders that are with us are going to be your neighbors. They are getting out. If we do not give them the necessary tools to succeed, they come back in and cost the state more money. The cheapest programming you have is sitting right behind me and to my side. This is it. Without this, you can't do it. Our officers are much more than just security. Our officers take care of the offender's needs on a daily basis, you name it. If an offender comes up and gets a bad phone call, the wife is left, the girlfriend's left, the mom is in the hospital, the dad is about ready to pass away, generally the first person they come and see is a correction officer. And the correction officer knows how to handle that, in which direction to go, who to call, and put them in the right direction to take care of that. We're great listeners. These offenders have multiple issues. Personal, medically, you name it, they have it. These folks are the ones that take care of that. Before they go to see the health services, before they go see a doctor, before they go to the hospital, they see us first. They model themselves after us. When you see the officers sent through here today, Anna had said it earlier, they model themselves after us, the good inmates do. They understand, they go, look, this gal or guy has it together. I want my life to be put together as well as them. Coming in every day just in a clean uniform. Come in and ready to do the job. Does more for the inmate population than anything that we have. Officer presence not only protects us, but the offenders. And when you talk to the offenders, they have some of the same concerns that our officers have at this point in time with security. Folks, we've neglected to get the officers that we've needed in the past. It's very disappointing that we had to have a loss of life before we acted on it. But it's very important that we support this bill, move this bill forward, and get the officers we need to protect the citizens of the state of Minnesota, the officers and staff that work in there, and the inmates themselves. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your testimony, and I really appreciate the folks that came in to talk to me personally. And they highlighted something that I would like to get on the public record, which was a little slightly alarming. If you could talk about what happens when there's an emergency, your emergency response team, and what they have to go through, and you know, how many folks you have to respond to something, and even as you have got someone in handcuffs or just that whole procedure and how that being short-staffed affect that. If you could kind of get that on the public record and let us understand that just a little bit, that process.
Yes, we have an emergency response team in each facility. Those folks are assigned that on a daily basis. Each facility is different in the numbers. At Stillwater, the number is 6 on a good day, 5 on a bad day. And these guys are trained to respond to every and any emergency that happens in the institution. If there's a fight, they respond to the fight. Separate the offenders, restrain the offenders, and move them separately to separate holding cells to get them into segregation. If there's an inmate that is hurt any way, shape, or fashion, we respond to that. We go to that. We render aid. We call for the health services and the LPNs. By the way, we do have one LPN with us today. I do want to make sure that we know about that. We get them into the health service. They get the aid they need at health services. And then if they need to go out, we have to, as Representative Constance said, we have to send two folks there. When we move the offenders, when we move them from a cell hall to segregation or a holding cell, we move them two officers at a time. Both officers on each side. That takes two officers out of the equation if anything happens. And we know it, and the offenders know it. So the offenders know now the numbers are really low because if we got to move 4 inmates, that's 8, at the minimum, 8 officers, and that pulls away from all the other staff. If we have to send somebody to the hospital, we got to send folks to settle them at the hospital to watch them there. That takes away from the institution and needs. And at this point in time, that really affects Stillwater, Oak Park Heights, and Lionel Lakes. Those are the three institutions that are responsible for the hospitals in the city's area. And then the outstate officers will handle anything that's in locally, whether it be Faribault, Moose Lake, Rush City, anything locally happen. But if they come to the city, they usually bring them down, they transport them down, and then it's our folks that sell them. And I got to cut it short.
Yeah, thank you, members. Just a reminder, we started a little bit late, so we're a little short on time, so if questions could be quick, please.
Mr. Chair, I do have a good quick follow-up.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. This will be a short answer, though. So in light of all of that, I'm concerned because when I looked at the governor's budget, he's only appropriating enough for 120 officers, and this bill actually does 210, which is a substantial difference. And I don't know if the commissioner's here. I thought I had seen him at some point somewhere. Okay. Maybe the author of the bill, the chair, could address that if you happen to know why such a big difference between your bill and what the governor's recommendations are. It's a big difference. So I'm just curious.
It is. The GOM bill is the ideal that we need to get to, but I think the reality is we're going to have a hard time getting 120 qualified people as things sit right now. We're going to put it out there as what the ideal is, and we're going to try to get as many as we possibly can. I believe it was Shakopee, though, last fall that advertised for, I think, 15 officers and got 5. The people sitting in the room are good staff. They're good people, and we do not want to lower those standards either. So,
Yes, we support the governor's bill, and the governor bill gives 120 officers. Plus, we have the commitment within that for 90 FTEs that aren't filled to get those filled immediately. We have good folks that will apply for the Department of Corrections. The department is diligently working on coming with new and creative and exciting ways to get folks on board. And we're going to find those folks and we're going to get them. This bill is very important. The governor's budget is very important. And to fill every position that we can is important. And I believe that there is nothing in his bill, in his budget that stops the shortfall for the correction officers and the members that we need.
Just a follow-up comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. And I was concerned when I looked at the vast difference between the two and knowing, I mean, you know, when the officers came and talked to me about especially emergency response and being pulled in different directions and overtime and missing family events, all of those things are so incredibly difficult to deal with. And so I was concerned, you know, with the big difference between the two. The last thing I was concerned about as well, which you addressed slightly, is how are we going to fill the spots? If we, you know, if we can fund it, then how are we going to fill those spots? And I would just encourage the chair and the bill author to, you know, to maybe think of some creative ways that we as a legislature can encourage that. And I'm not sure exactly how that looks, but I don't know. I don't think the commissioner's come back, but maybe he's got some plans as to how to fill. Is he back there? Oh, he is here. Okay. Maybe he has some thoughts about how he would work to fill those spots as they are so vitally important.
Just remind the commissioner that we have another bill.
Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, yes. We, as a department, we have really been working on streamlining the hiring process. Changes in recruitment processes will take place. We're really working to kind of be localized in terms of facility-based recruitment. Right now, everyone has to come to St. Paul. Mm-hmm. We're changing some of our testing protocols, engaging more of our staff in the selection process. And ultimately, we believe that we can turn, or right now is a hiring process that can take weeks or months, into a week and maintain and get high-quality people with comprehensive background checks done. But it's going to really require a different type of mobilization of our HR staff. And right now we are working on that. We think that will help greatly.
Mr. Chair. Representative
O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's encouraging to hear. And, you know, I know that there's a lot of schools around the state that also are training officers. So hopefully you're closely tied to them and even, you know, into the high schools to encourage them and, you know, see some of these officers maybe visit once in a while to a high school or something just to show them that there's another path too and there's another opportunity. But I'm encouraged by that, so thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Very good. Representative Mary Ein.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Representative O'Neill asked the bulk of or the heart of what I wanted to ask. I do want to quickly express my privilege to be here with so many of our men and women from our corrections officer ranks. Mr. Chair, as you know, you and I, Representative Christensen, spent hours a few weeks ago, both with resident inmates and also with our correction officers and staff, and it was pretty clear that the pain, there's tremendous pain that exists, you know, in this community. I think it's spread across and obviously related to the, directly related to the loss of their beloved colleague and friend. I just think it's incredibly powerful that your chairmanship has had the wisdom to not just make decisions from here, disconnected from interacting with that reality, but actually to be there. And prior to that, a number of us from both sides of the aisle attended the first ever hearing held, a legislative hearing in a corrections facility. Let me just say really quickly, this is along Representative O'Neill's questions, and, you know, we don't need to go deep into the, you know, there'll be time for this. So the governor has 120, plus there's a commitment to fill the 90 that had been made before. My understanding is that appropriations have been made for that. Funds were there. There have been efforts to fill those slots, and we've not been successful in doing that. I suspect that's going to get a little bit harder now. To do, I hope not, but to do because precisely of the tragedy that we witnessed in Stillwater. And so I'll leave this just sort of as an open-ended you know, observation as opposed to a question because of time, but we'll continue this conversation. It does seem to me that if the state is going to appropriate, and I think it should, resources to make sure that we fill the ranks of our correction officers so that there is an appropriate level of staffing and safety is first and foremost at the center of that. that we really have to address, you know, what is it that's gotten in the way? Because we currently have resources. We currently have made efforts to bring people in. You know, pay, benefits, supports. I heard a lot that night how many of our men and women in the ranks didn't feel supported. And I think any other sector, other things might have happened to provide, you know, that kind of support. I know, Commissioner, you and I have talked about ways in which to do that. But it seems to me if we're going to attract the best in Minnesota, which is what we should be doing, you know, to this vital work, I mean, we've got to address that full, you know, array of issues and others. And I would be more comfortable, I mean, I obviously support House File 1315, but I would be more comfortable if we were simultaneously addressing those issues as well. And then the final thing, Mr. Chair, is that we also met with other staff, not just the correction officers, you know, providing security. It was pretty clear, two things. One is that there was a really strong bond between the two, you know, professional class. They were very supportive of one another. But two, it also, you know, as I'm learning about this, that it also got across the idea to me that safety isn't just about, you know, a security, you know, professional in the room. It is about that. But it's also about those supportive staff to provide the kind of services that creates a kind of environment where the inmates, the residents, are feeling hopeful and engaged so that they're not thinking other things and acting out in other ways. It seems to me that's also part of the whole safety message. And so I would hope that as we go forward, Mr. Chair, that we're also addressing what I think is a holistic approach to safety, which is to make sure that those ranks are also powerfully being replenished and populated and supported as well. But I thank you for the bill, and I look forward to ongoing conversation with it.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Before I give it to the author for some last remarks, I just want to take the opportunity to thank all the officers who are here today and those tuning in on the live stream. It's the hope of this subcommittee that this legislation will be able to empower you. And, you know, over the years, our state has not done enough to invest in you, in our facilities, and it's our hope that we can you know, work together and continue to work with you to keep you and our community safe and secure. So thank you for being here, and thank you that for the work that you do and the sacrifices that you make to keep our state safe. And with that, Mr. Chair, if you have any closing remarks.
Thank you, and I can also make my own motion. just address, again, with Representative O'Neill, I view this as being the first bill. I really want to see us move forward with some other supports for the custody staff in the future. We need to learn how to deal with PTSD, the trauma, the stress, anger issues that are out there. It's a difficult job. I've also gotten a preliminary report from the Legislative Auditor's Office about life expectancy. That one's a little frightening, and I need to delve into it, but it looks like custody staff on average may have about a 10-year shorter life expectancy, and we need to deal with some of the issues that are causing these things. So like I said, this is a first bill. We are going to continue to look for ways to improve the safety for everybody. The other bill that we heard before, and Representative O'Neill was so kind to help with a lot of tweaks, the Ombudsman bill, if we can improve communications, I think that will go. But again, that was something we heard at Stillwater the other night about communications. There's a lot of things still to do, but we are getting short in time, so I'm going to stop. And I will renew my motion to have this held over for the omnibus bill.
So laid over.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right, members and members of the public, we have one more bill. I'm presenting the bill. I will do my best to keep it short. We might have to go a couple minutes over time, but I will condense my presentation out of respect for the members and the public's time.
Vice Chair, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. For the record, I'm Representative Dan Waldenot, and I am honored to be representing the Minnesota Correctional Facility in St. Cloud and the brave men and women who work there. This morning, I am presenting my bill for consideration that would assist in remedying the low level of support and clinical staff in our state's correctional facilities. House File 1615 is my bill to fund 176 FTEs to support the proper functioning of our state's correctional system. In addition to the essential security officer positions that are needed, like we've heard about earlier this morning, support for clinical staffing increases ought to be part of our package as well. These workers include the folks who will hire and attract corrections officers, nurses, and other professionals, maintain our prison's infrastructures, ensure proper staffing levels of nurses and other medical professionals, and more. It will take a true and all-of-the-above approach to make sure our correctional facilities are properly staffed with security officers, nurses, and others to create a well-functioning system, one that keeps all staff and the general public in our communities safe and secure. And, Mr. Chair, I've brought with me a representative from MAPE to testify in favor of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members, for purposes of brevity, Richard Kajewski, Public Affairs and Communications Director at MAPE, we strongly support this bill. This bill does add some additional case managers for the integrated case management program that was implemented without additional staffing. It also adds some of our counselors, both for sex offender treatment, drug treatment, and mental health. Those are real important to the correctional facilities. These programming staff, as one of the previous testifiers was talking about, when they're short staffed in an area, offenders know where to go and what to do if they want to get away with it. And so it's not always security staff, but when you short areas in programming, it has an effect on shortening security staff, and it can create a problem for security in these correctional facilities as well. So we're happy to see this bill moving forward. And, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you for hearing the bill.
Thank you so much. And shorting the programming makes the communities less safe, too. So, Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Waldenot, do you have a breakdown on the 176? I'm a little confused about what that 176 is, and have you requested a fiscal note on this?
Mr. Chair, we Representative Poston, we have requested a fiscal note. We are not a finance committee, but there's urgency that we need these this staff in our facilities, so that's why we're moving on this legislation at this time. And to further answer your question about that number, the 176 number, I'd like to invite Commissioner Snell to come in and speak to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the number of bodies are really built into a wide spectrum of need. That includes some security staff just in order to have and maintain those areas, which some of that is represented in the complement proposed in the governor's budget. In addition to that, as was mentioned, integrated case management, which this evening we'll be talking more about an overview of the budget with the committee, and we'll go into that in more detail. But integrated case management is a core part of that. Some expansion of our medical staff nursing will be a part of this, and along with just the ability to facilitate and run some of the treatment-based programs are built into these dollars. We also recognize the fact that we are seeking to phase this in. Ultimately, as we look at population controls and look at implementing our security staff, one of the things that we know is that if in order to run programming, we have to have security personnel, as was pointed out, to get people to the programming. And so right now we find ourselves in a position of having to juggle, one necessitates the other. And so I think this is one of the challenges that we're facing, but the totality of these positions are reflected in even additional like psychiatric services that we purchase through our medical contract for the provision of services to folks who suffer from both severe and persistent mental illnesses as well as kind of acute matters of crisis. So ultimately, this number is addressed in a whole variety of ways, and this evening we can talk more about the specific details of that.
Thank you, Commissioner.
If I may, I did point out that when we did the tour, at one point we stopped and the custody staff was pointing out some of the maintenance deficiencies. So I believe a couple of the positions are just our maintenance people, just to try to get things up online. And we did hear when we went back about a number of toilets that were broken. So you believe me, there's nothing more important at some points than that. So there's a wide, and power plant, there's a wide variety of folks that come into this. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's funny that you say that, you know, you must have gone back behind where all the pipes were and they were leaking and all that. I have been there. I've had the good fortune and have been very encouraged to go and see all the facilities. So of the 11 prisons, I've been to 10, and I still have to get to Togo. It's on my list. But not now. It's too cold. Too much snow. But I will get there. So my question is actually about phase-in. So the previous bill that we just heard talked about, it was very explicit as far as a phase-in and how many, you know, in each broad category. It's not discussed in this bill. Is that something that you intend to do, or how are you going to phase these folks in?
Mr. Chair, I that's something we're taking a look at. As we get the fiscal note back and are able to take a look at those numbers, that will further help us take the best approach so that we can get the funding to where it needs to go to make sure we're supporting the commissioner's efforts and that we're supporting the folks that are in our facilities.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I look forward to some more detail, too, as to where these folks are. And, you know, I happen to know, too, after going through several of the prisons, some of them more than once. And my special thing that I love to talk about is treatment. I mean, that's, you know, as they know, when I'm being brought through different prisons, asking about what treatment are you offering here, because each one's a little bit different in what they're able to offer. But I know that it's also really, really challenging as it is to hire corrections officers. It's even more challenging to hire, you know, staff that are doing the treatment, whether it be chemical dependency treatment or just, basic living skills and things like that. It's difficult on all levels. Is there a plan, just like I had asked the chair and his bill, is there a plan to recruit and to find these folks? Because they're few and far between, and it's, you know, as great as Minnesota is, our unemployment is like 2.3%, so it's really hard to find these folks.
I can probably address some of that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I can address a little bit of that. One of the things that we have done is we've established a couple of recruitment positions that are doing, as you suggested earlier, visiting with the colleges, including like the licensed chemical dependency treatment programs around the state, to try and get in front of those students before they graduate, so that they recognize that the Department of Corrections does become a viable place of employment, that their services are needed, and we believe that in the long haul, working for the state is a great place to work. We are a great employer, but we have to make sure that we're in front of those folks, that they recognize us as an option. And I think it speaks to, as you pointed out earlier, just the need for us to be more actively engaged and out there because of the low unemployment and encouraging people to come our way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will be reviewing the commissioner's budget tonight at the Public Safety Committee, chaired by Representative Mariani, and we'll probably be going into a lot more detail at that particular time. Anybody else have any more questions? Anybody from the audience like to make a any questions? Representative Wilmot, you get the last word, and you can move your own bill, too.
Alrighty. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again, committee members. The men and women who work in our correctional facilities deserve to do so in a safe and secure environment. So, members, I urge your support for this legislation, and I move that that House File 1615 be laid over for consideration for inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you, members, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll hold it over for possible inclusion. Any other comments? Again, would like to thank the members of the. Did you get to your other thing? Oh, good. We've got a lot of overlap, and so it has been a struggle for people to get to this as an extra meeting. So, really appreciate the members making that effort. We're adjourned.
This hearing, and today's hearing is really quite simple. It's to have a walkthrough of the governor's corrections budget, and we're joined today by officials from the corrections department to walk us through that. There's a PowerPoint that we'll be referencing that should be also copied at each of the members' desks, and we have distributed the budget books as well. Members, I would ask that you let my LA Jason know whether or not you want to take your book with you. I'm okay with that. I know oftentimes members prefer to just read it at their own comfort and mark it up, et cetera. My only caution is make sure you bring it to the meetings because, you know, you'll be able to reference it later on as we start, marking up the appropriations parts of our omnibus bill. You're certainly free to leave them here, and committee staff will make sure that we'll shuttle them back and forth between meetings. So with that, Chair Constant, I'm going to turn to you and have you lead us in the presentation of the corrections budget.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Commissioner Stell, would you like to begin?
Thank you, chairs and committee member. It's an honor to be able to present the governor's budget tonight on corrections. I also want to just make sure that I speak to the fact that we're really appreciative of the time and attention the committee has given to corrections in general over the past several weeks. It's much appreciated, and I think it's helpful. Brings, I think, incredible attention to the hard work that corrections does, and is much appreciated. You are given two packets tonight. One is it provides the budget overview. This is the governor's budget. These were the additions in requests that are being made. And the second one is a supplementary PowerPoint. And that supplementary document really provides background information on the distribution of our budget that may be useful and maybe something that we can refer to as we take questions. With me tonight is Chris Dodge, who's the Chief Financial Officer, and I will readily defer to him when it comes to the finer points of the numbers. In addition, we have a whole myriad of Department of Corrections staff here to be able to answer most any question that members may have. With that, I just would like to say that as we presented the budget, I made this request to the governor and had conversations with the governor about the budget that we're going to present to you tonight. We wanted a budget that really reflected the whole of the Department of Corrections. Oftentimes, as you all know, that we can think about corrections or think about any form of government by virtue of its units or its function. In our case, we are typically divided in two areas, one being the facilities or the prison side, the other being field services. Ultimately, as we began to think about our budget and what the budget reflected, we felt that it was really important that we work across the divisions, recognize the importance of each of their respective work, and at the same time, understand that the two are inextricably linked in many respects. And that is what I believe this budget reflects. This budget reflects, I think, ultimately, what is a focus on our mission. And we've talked about this as the reduction of recidivism, the promotion of offender change, the use of proven strategies, and ultimately that affects the public safety through effective community supervision. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Dodge to talk a little bit about the distribution of the budget.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Dodge, and I am the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Corrections. We just have a couple of overview slides on our budget. Our fiscal year 19 budget is $588.139 million. It represents about 2.5% of the governor's total general fund budget, and 96% of our operating budget comes from the general fund. So we have very limited other funds available. 13% of our budget is pass-through money that goes directly to our county partners, and the other 87% is direct services for the department. We do have three divisions or programs in our agency. The largest in terms of dollars and FTEs is the Correctional Institutions Division, 73.3% of our budget, Community Services, 22% of our budget, and Operations Support, which is all of the support functions, including human resources, finance, policy and legal, planning and performance, and others, represents only less than 5% of our overall budget, general fund budget.
The budget request really is focused on a variety of 10 key areas, and we're going to have a moment to kind of talk about each of these and their importance. At the end, the total amount of this the funding request is approximately $111 million. And I'm going to walk us through each of these areas, so we'll go into them in a bit more detail and can answer questions that members may have. First and foremost was the need for an operating adjustment, and this becomes somewhat of a question that many people oftentimes ask. This really becomes, how do we fund the base budget of the Department of Corrections? In other words, how do we fund things like step increases or the state's portion of health insurance costs or the state's portion of pension costs that get passed along or federal tax obligations? Because of the way the budget is done, these funds are not projected into the future, and so each biennium we need to come back with a request to address and cover the costs associated with our current operations. And as you can see, it is in 20, it is 10.5 million, and in 21, it is $17.7 million. This, as I said, is simply to keep our budget operational. And if we did not have this funding, this is the equivalent of upwards of 300 FTEs. This funding is what this funding represents. And so I think it does become important that people just understand that this is not something that the department caused to happen. It is something that is just a part of being an employer and having the obligations that we have, either by contract, by law, or by the costs associated with being an employer. one of the key areas, the large areas that is in this budget, is really prison security and safety. And this has been one of the areas that has received considerable attention. And this is broken into kind of three broad areas: staffing, some security infrastructure and technology modernization, and then, of course, the restrictive housing program or segregation, which has received a considerable amount of attention. This is a total request of above $44 million over the biennium, and we'll talk about what this looks like. Ultimately, when we talked about this, we wanted to focus on a staffing analysis that really looks at the way in which we do our business across all of the operational divisions. And operational divisions meaning the prison side as well as the field side. We want to make sure that we're creating safer, more secure prison environments for both our staff and for the inmates that we house. We want to make sure that we increase the safety of our community by ensuring that the quality of programming that we offer meets the needs of those people who are going to be coming back to our community. And as we've talked about in this committee before, 95% of those in our correctional facilities will be coming back to communities across our state. This request also includes increases for staffing of operations and programming, including the addition of 120 correctional officers over the biennium. Another core element was the look at technology and prison technology modernization. We know that in our facilities, and many of you had the opportunity to see some of this in action, our facilities really operate with the use of technology. Incredible investments in cameras that allow us to monitor certain areas of the facility, which keeps our officers as well as those who live in our facilities safer. We have over 5,000 workstations throughout the Department of Corrections and 400 servers. We connect to a variety of state and federal criminal justice information systems. And obviously, one of the key things that has come up in the committee before is our need to be able to provide you as policymakers with key information so that you can make good decisions around how you fund us, and hold us accountable to the work that we need to accomplish on behalf of Minnesota. This is an investment, one-time investment in replacement and updating of security systems, cameras, cell door controls, and perimeter protection. In addition, it updates obsolete security systems and addresses those issues where data privacy could be compromised. We also, in this area, focus on the fact that we want to engage in evidence-based practices. The need for that, that has been an area of...
Commissioner Snell?
Yes.
Chair Mariani has a question.
Thank you, Chair Considine. I guess the first question is of you. Is would you prefer that we ask questions as we go along in the budget or wait to the entire presentation?
If you're asking my preference, I would say that we do it at the end of each unit.
I defer to the chairs in terms of how you'd like to manage that.
Well, Mr. Chair, my question goes back to the prison security and safety staffing. So maybe that's the end of one unit because you're in infrastructure now. And I know that earlier this morning in the corrections subcommittee, there was a conversation relative to the bill that you authored about the correctional officers, but I know that members of this committee who are not on that have not had the benefit of that conversation, and that could be a long one, but really basically My question is just a short one. If the commissioner can tell us, you know, what is the relationship of the 120 correctional officers in the governor's bill relative to the, I don't know if it's 80 or I think that's right, officers that that the department has had the direction and the appropriations to fill. Is that 80 within this 120, or is that a separate number? So it's really to that issue.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an addition. At present, we have, again, this is a moving target. We just had an academy start in the past week. But, you know, we talked about having 80 current vacancies, 80 to 90 current vacancies. Those positions remain unfilled, or we're in the process of working to fill them. This would be on top of that. So if we take 80, we're really talking about between now and the end of the biennium, the next biennium, we're talking about the need to hire 200 additional correctional officers. So this, when we think about prison safety and security from the standpoint of restrictive housing, this has been an area of considerable attention. Representative Zerwas has had a lot of interest, and we'll be talking more about this, I believe, with a bill that's going to be coming up, tomorrow. But we really are focusing on, as we look to better make our facilities safer, we need to make sure that we're investing heavily in evidence-based practices that we know, based on what the evidence and what the data tells us, can reduce recidivism and address offender misconduct. The budget proposal includes the ability for us to maximize this by increasing caseworkers, by increasing behavioral health staff, by providing more cognitive skills therapy and mental health counseling at multiple facilities, especially those facilities that provide and carry out restrictive housing measures throughout the system. Offender health care has been an area of considerable interest and no doubt considerable cost. I believe last session there was a bill that did not was included, but did not become law. What this request does is it addresses the critical need for us to fulfill our contractual obligations for offender health care. It expands nursing care in our facilities to provide 24/7 nursing care in three more of our facilities, and meets the both federal and state requirement that we have an electronic health record system. I would just point out that the photograph there is an actual photograph of the way that our records are today stored. And this creates significant challenges for our medical personnel, especially when offenders leave our facilities and go to either into, for instance, a halfway house, and there may be some type of medical issue, and the ability to access these records, while it can be done, it's not done efficiently, and it's not done in accordance with both state and federal mandates. This budget request would address that by providing broadening our access to an electronic health record system through our current medical provider. We spend right now nearly $90 million a year on healthcare services to people in our corrections facilities. So this is really an incredible number, and I think reflects the broad range of needs of those that are in our facilities. both on the mental health as well as medical fronts. Integrated case management is also a proven and an evidence-based approach. This ultimately reduces the number of people on caseloads. It focuses on positive behavioral approaches and addressing criminogenic thinking. It is ultimately proven to reduce recidivism in a significant way. And particularly, this resource is applied to those offenders who are deemed as being highest risk and having the highest levels of need. We also focus, and we know, and the research has told us, that these cognitive skills-based interventions with this population becomes critically important. I like to describe this as this integrated case management is almost intensive case management, and it provides for what I believe should be a warm handoff between of the offender between when they are in prison and going into reentry services, going out into the field, and I think there was a time when because of the way we were able to manage which a much smaller population, where field agents and case managers in the facility were able to manage that handoff in a very kind of human way, where they had talked and had worked and collaborated together around that that offender. And I think what an integrated case management would do is would allow us to have that that happen again, in particular for those inmates, those offenders, where that need is greatest. Pretrial assessment and supervision. About 25% of Minnesota counties have pretrial assessment and supervision, mostly on a small scale. A recent policy change by the judicial branch to reduce disparities in pretrial detention for those oftentimes who cannot make bail. This was a requirement that counties begin to provide pretrial assessment and supervision of these people accused of or facing charges. This provides for the assessment of those folks in county jails, and develops supervision strategies to be able to manage them in the community, which those with resources would normally participate in through the use of bail. And we do this by using validated assessment tools that it also ensures the protection of the community as we do this. This comes with about an $8 million cost over the biennium. But we believe it is a part of really looking at corrections more systemically, how we manage offenders from the time they enter the system all the way through to reentry, and what we hope and what we work toward is pro-social reintegration. Intensive supervised release. Intensive supervised release has been around for some period of time. Intensive supervised release provides agents to go out and provide around-the-clock supervision of these people at various different times of the night and the day. These offenders are oftentimes people who have a highest risk for violence and oftentimes have the highest need. They can include predatory offenders, and with ISR or intensive supervised release, there are statutory requirements in terms of caseload size because the legislature saw when this was developed the need for that to be intensive, to that to be focused so that we could ensure community safety through sound supervision. These agents oftentimes work in partnership with one another. There's two agents who do this, and what this budget request would do, again, just shy of $10 million over the biennium. It improves the ISR agent's safety. They can work in pairs. It better addresses the broad range of needs, increases our ability to add put people out on ISR. And ultimately, if one of our strategies is to reduce our population, one of the ways we can help do that is by restructuring people who may have had a technical violation in the community to a period of intensive supervision. This also invests in safety supplies, such as radios, that can be used in areas where there is no cell phone coverage. And this really is an important, as many of you know, my previous life was as a police chief just recently in Invergrove Heights, and their Dakota County agents who were working intensive supervision had access to a police radio. They would check out on calls, and the officers throughout the county were aware of where they were in the event that there would be a problem. And it was just really sound practice and really important for the safety of the agents and really the safety of the community. This includes, included in this is not simply the DOC, but there is a significant portion of dollars that are pass-through dollars that go out to Community Corrections Act counties who are providing this supervision in the community. It provides the services as well, both in the metro area as well as outstate. Victim notification and juvenile correctional records management system. This really is about the replacement and rebuilding of systems that are outdated. And we all know, I think, the importance of corrections in terms of the work with victims. Part of the business of justice is ensuring that victims feel like they have a voice. That they know what's happening. And for many victims, wanting to have and receive the information, which I would add is a right by Minnesota law, this system becomes necessary. This is an investment of dollars in rebuilding a system that has that it was antiquated and discontinued operation, and allows victims to opt in, to register, and to receive notifications in the event of a change of placement of an offender, which we believe is fundamentally empowering. In addition to that, these dollars also address upgrades to the juvenile management system, which is really the records management system, and does a better job of connecting this system to the DOC's central comm system. This becomes necessary because right now this system is operating off of very old technology and not something that can be sustained over the long haul. Electronic monitoring and transitional housing for high-risk offenders. We know that effective monitoring and housing does become important elements of reducing recidivism and maximizing community safety. Over the last several years, there has been a significant increase in the use of electronic monitoring and transitional housing because oftentimes, when some of these offenders are released from our facilities, they simply cannot access housing. Electronic monitoring becomes one of the keys that we manage those offenders that are of highest risk. And the ability to access some forms of transitional housing in the community is a way of getting people out of our facilities in accordance with the law and managing them in the community and being able to more adequately supervise them while they're out, which obviously becomes an important part of our mission and really our responsibility to the people of Minnesota. These dollars would help us, we believe, also when it comes to addressing some of the churn that ultimately affects officer safety within our facilities, as well as the safety of residents inside of our facilities. Because of the number of short-term returnees that are coming back into our facilities, we think that some of these dollars can help us to manage those people in the community in a better way through electronic monitoring or through accessing some of the transitional housing programs or halfway house programs that we currently utilize, but we could potentially be more effective in managing the use of those beds with these dollars. Corrections opioid treatment provisions, as many of you know, is really part of the overall opioid package that both the Senate and the House have been discussing. We know that an increasing number of people are coming into the Department of Corrections with opioid addiction, and we need to have a broader range of tools to address this. What this does is it invests in pre-release planning services, and the establishment and maximization of our treatment programs targeted at opioid addiction and the use of medication-assisted treatment options within the facilities. And I believe several of the county jails are initiating this as well, because the number of people that are leaving our facilities and die as a result of opioid addiction is a very real and present issue, and this is a method of being able to manage that. Finally, we talk about reducing recidivism through connecting families and reentry programs. This is really a $2 million investment over the course of the biennium. This invests in transportation services to reduce visiting barriers for children of incarcerated offenders. We know the more connection there is between offenders, those who are incarcerated, and their families, in particular their children, the less likely they are to recidivate. And this becomes one of the important tools. We also need to recognize that we know that upon release, having adequate community-based supports becomes an important feature of success. Ultimately, we believe providing services to be able to keep these families together, to be able to keep the families of incarcerated offenders visiting, maintaining that relationship becomes a core component of successful reintegration and reentry. Second component of this is improving parenting skills for incarcerated parents. One of the things that I found remarkable when I arrived at the Department of Corrections was some of the feedback we received from people who had been released from prison. And one of the most demanded programs was an interest in parenting programs. And I think that's it's critically important as we think about how it is that we break the cycle of offending and that can happen within families. This becomes one of the key ways to address that. And what this does is it provides dollars for parenting skills programming that is evidence-based and is effective at helping these offenders when they get back into the community more effectively parent and become part and parcel to keeping their children out of the very system that they're leaving. And then finally, I just left this afternoon the meeting of the MIAC, the tribal with the tribes, and certainly one of the areas of interest for them was ensuring a commitment on behalf of Minnesota and the Department of Corrections in this case that we would honor and recognize what oftentimes we think is the need to provide highly culturally specific services to incarcerated Native Americans in our facilities. We oftentimes think that the best way to do things is the way we believe we should do things. And I think ultimately when we think about Native Americans in our facilities, to be smart, to be culturally responsive, I think is a reflection of our desire to make sure that our system is as equitable as it can be, and to be able to make an investment of having Native American programs that are exist in our communities to provide services to Native American offenders before they release and upon their release becomes one of the key and critical issues, we think, to addressing the profound disparities that exist with Native Americans in the criminal justice system in general. And with that, chairs and committee members, I would open it up to questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Snell. And I just actually have a comment. This afternoon I learned about a program in Michigan for reentry in which they are connecting the residents as they are leaving with their local community health centers, setting up appointment within the first week to establish primary care, but then also to have a continuity of care, particularly as it comes to behavioral medicine. And like I said, just heard about that this afternoon. I'm not sure how fast we can get something together for that, maybe a pilot program, but I really liked it. Also very interested in the parenting program. If I may, 1991, I won the statewide award for jail programs with a parenting program in Blue Earth County. So it's something that, yeah, I've had interest in for some time. I can see Representative O'Neill is now bending her microphone. So Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's actually to that point. I happen to know that there used to be a bus that went around and picked up the kids and brought them to the prisons. But that program ended, and can you explain why it ended? And I know a nonprofit, maybe some churches or something, had done the same thing, and they also came into the same difficulty. So can you explain what actually happened and why that program was ended?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, the exact reason I can't, but I know that part of it was based on some funding. Ultimately, I think we need to make a commitment to this because this is really an important and key proven strategy around reconnection. And I believe that in many cases, some of that was continued because of the kind of philanthropic efforts of some of the nonprofits who are providing those services. But after a period of time, it becomes difficult for them to continue to do that. And I think over the course of time, based on some of the historical data that I've looked at, there has been changes and desires to look at a range of different programming, and oftentimes we forget about the most basic of services, and that is keeping these families together. And to your point, I think we need to make a commitment. I think that's reflected in the budget to try to keep these families together during incarceration.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill, you have a follow-up?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was understanding that they didn't have any kids to pick up, that the kids just didn't have interests or they couldn't get anyone to actually come to the prisons. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I believe that one of the things that we know was that there had some of the challenges that they faced was the ability to kind of connect with. When there was services that were reaching out to the families, to the moms or the dads or grandparents or whoever the children were living with, when those arrangements were made and there was strong connections made, the young people did access those services. One of the things that I think has become clear is that in the absence of good wraparound services, and that's one of the things that with this program we would like to see included, is that there is a level of support for making arrangements for those kids to be able to get out and visit their incarcerated parents, but also to process what that experience is like when they leave. Because I think we all know what it can mean for some of us to be inside those facilities. I can only imagine how difficult it could be for young people. But we have to be the ones to help make that happen. And I think that's what this program would include.
Another follow-up, yes. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell. I would just caution that if we're going to do this again, that we have a good plan in place so that we actually have kids to pick up and, you know, we don't put all that money into it and they don't actually want to come or are aware of it. Or I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I know that there weren't kids actually to pick up, and that's why the program ended. On another question, though, you know, I was the chair of the Subcommittee on Employee Relations and had the opportunity to review 18 of the state employee contracts. And in so doing, looking back at the historical information, I found that one contract alone out of those 18, the information provided to the SCR as to how much that contract would cost was actually off by 40%. And so when that money was actually spent and that contract was actually implemented, across the board, it was a 40% increase, more than what was anticipated. And I'm seeing something in your budget proposal that sort of speaks to that, and that was something that we had great concern about. And I actually asked the former commissioner, well, he's now the commissioner again, Commissioner Franz, if he could commit to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations that he in fact had talked to the commissioners to make sure that these increases could be absorbed within the budgets already passed, and he assured me that they could, but now I'm seeing that that's not actually true. I see $28 million that you are, you know, and it's interesting to me that it's $28 million and we haven't hired the 80, so I'm not sure how that all calculates in that, you know, we had appropriated for 80 more corrections officers. So can you just speak to that? And it's really a great concern that the contracts are looked at not as deeply as they probably should so that we can do proper budgeting when we come to here. And so I think my concern is that we do proper budgeting here so we really know what the contracts are going to cost and that whatever parameters that we set, the contracts are actually negotiated within those parameters, and historically they have not been. And so I'm bringing that to your attention and see if you have a comment about that as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, one of the things that was, to be honest, was eye-opening for me was the fact that in many of the governments that I've worked at prior, mostly municipal governments, that when there was an authorized staffing strength, that was projected, the costs were projected over the course of the term of employment. That is not how the state budgets in terms of this. They establish the budget on a number of FTEs for a biennium or for a given period of time. And a lot of the cost tails that go along with that employment in accordance with the contract, whether that step increases, or changes to pension are not factored. And what ends up happening then is if you have, and I'm just going to use a number to make it simple, if we have an authorized strength of 100, and we don't factor the entire life of the contract of those 100 employees, that essentially what happens here is that we are coming in and having to ask for it oftentimes in arrears of actions that we simply aren't a part of. That changes in policy, whether that's on the pension side or on healthcare costs, come up after a budget gets set. And to be frank, that's going to happen potentially again, depending upon the outcomes of collective bargaining that is going on now. This contract does not make any assumptions for increases in any increases in collective bargaining that may happen going forward. And so ultimately, the Department of Corrections finds itself in a position of oftentimes having to play catch up.
Just one final comment.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your deference. So that would be my concern and my caution, that you would be very closely connected to those that are actually negotiating the budgets that you have to live within. That's something that hasn't been done historically as I look back through, you know, biennium after biennium. We are in the exact same position as you just stated, that these contracts are negotiated and the legislature is told that the contracts fall within the parameters of the budget already passed, when in fact they don't, and then you come back and say, oh, I need $28 million more, or, you know, it depends on the agency, $100 million, or, you know, I mean, it's hundreds of millions of dollars more than what was anticipated. So my ask is that you would stick very closely to Commissioner Franz and make sure that we have those contracts negotiated within the parameters of what we're passing here, because it's just a cyclical thing that's happening, you know, biennium after biennium after biennium. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. And I would tell you that we are looking at a program for a bus to take children. But your second part of your budget, I have some concerns about the budget, and I want to look at it a little bit closer and make sure that everything spells out. But we are looking at a program that would take children to Shakopee and reconnect them with their mothers. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming here tonight, Commissioner. I'm looking at my different things here, and I'm sort of new to this, so I have a question, if you could probably point me to it. On the county pass-through funding on your supplemental sheets, with the CCA, the way I understand it, I had some people come and talk to me in my office, and that's the subsidy to those 34 counties that essentially help with probation services. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What is the proposed increase in that in the next biennium? I'm not quite. I think it's in this book, but I'm not quite finding how it's divided out. So, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Miller?
Yep.
Okay. So two of our components do include funding for pass-through to the counties. One of them is, and bear with me here while I find it.
This is in my budget book.
Right. One of them is for the pretrial assessment and supervision. Okay. That does include $1.75 million in fiscal year 20 and $3.5 million in fiscal year 21. To go to CCA and CPO counties.
Okay.
And then the other one is intensive supervised release, and that includes approximately $2 million in fiscal year 20 and $4 million in fiscal year 21 to go to CCA counties. The percentage we use is approximately DOC is the recipient of about 36% of these funds, and the county partners are a recipient of about 64% of the funding.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Miller, you have a follow-up?
Afterwards can point where this, I mean, I know it's in here, but I still didn't find it. Just rough, what's the percentage increase on those into the next, over the next biennium? Just rough.
The total pass-through funding now is about $75 million. Mm-hmm. This would increase it by about $7.5 million a year, so probably about 10% overall.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just comment on that, that it also comes with the new responsibilities, too, for the CCA counties. So just if that's your concern.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, then one final comment on that.
Okay, go ahead.
So I know some probation service people, and they're, I'm sure you know this way better than I do, but those are stress services at this time. And those are the, if we're going to put a point of emphasis in our system on the probationary side of it, we need to make sure that we certainly have that. I hear phrases like drive-by probationary services and things like that, because you just can't keep up with the sheer number of people with the resources available. So if we're going to put an ever-increasing emphasis on probation services as opposed to incarceration, just make sure that the budgets reflect that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Yeah. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair, Commissioner. So for prison security and safety, you have allotted $20 million in fiscal year 20. I see that it was great to see the correction officers here today. That's good. I see 120 correctional officers, but how about for on page 13, the third bullet down, increased caseworkers and behavioral staff? I mean, I imagine you're a social worker. You know, I met a lot of these people in the prisons have underlying mental health issues. I know that you're doing a pretty good job in treating them, but how in this budget, how many more behavioral workers and staff are you anticipating adding with that?
So in, Mr. Chair, Representative, in this proposal, we are looking to increase, let me find it here, in our case management area, there is the expansion of staff to the tune of 24 additional FTEs for case management and support services in the facilities to work with and manage the needs of these offenders.
Representative Edelson, you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Chair. Yes. So for the 24 of the prisons, will they equally be divided? How will that work in terms of staffing?
The exact allocation, Representative, will be identified based upon need. And we have some facilities where there is a significantly higher need in terms of the, and when I talk about need, I'm talking about risk and need. Because ultimately we want to make sure that we're applying those resources to the offenders that have the highest risk and the highest criminogenic need.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the Commissioner, thank you for coming this evening and presenting to the committee. Commissioner, there's a pretty big gap between what we have as a requested correctional officer request coming from the majority party bill, and I'm a co-author on the bill, and from what's coming down in the governor's budget. I'm just wondering, I think we talked about this a little bit this morning, but for individuals that weren't able to be there, part of that discussion, if you could elaborate on kind of what's being brought forward from the representatives of the line employees versus what's coming down in the budget from the governor's office and the department, if you could address that difference.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, yes, I think when we looked at this, we factored in the current vacancies that we have, and wanted to be really realistic about what we believe we can actually hire and get into the facilities. We think that was first and foremost. The other thing I would point out is that the GOM bill is over two bienniums. The proposed is a single. And I think really it became important for us to really think about what we could realistically do. There is no doubt, and we've had this discussion before about the need that exists. The question really is, we did not want to come in and make an ask that we did not believe that we could satisfy in a meaningful way.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point about being able to fill the positions that you're authorized to hire for, if you could recap for the Joint Committee the number of current openings and the strategy to fill the current openings that you can't have yet been unable to fill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I think when we looked at this issue, there's a whole variety of factors that we are taking into account. First and foremost, one of the things that we need to do is really look at the competitiveness of us as an employer with correctional officers. As we've talked about before in the committee, many of the counties are bringing people in at between $3 to $5, $6, $7 an hour more than where our COs are starting. In order to attract and retain those dollars become important. Now, let me be clear. Working for the state and working for the Department of Corrections is a great career. And over the course of a lifetime, I think the earnings are good. The benefits are good. But ultimately, in order to attract and retain, we really need to make to bring people in. The second thing that we realized is that over the course of time, in particular when the job market was very different, we would have hundreds of people applying for a very small number of openings. But today, we find ourselves that flipped. We have, in many cases, 100-plus openings across the DOC in general and very few applicants. So one of the things that we began to look at is, are there ways that we could bring people on quicker while maintaining kind of high levels of standards around who we bring in the door? And by working with HR and MMB, we are in the process of devising a plan and really executing this plan where we would do more facility-based recruitment and hiring. That would allow people who may be from that given community or broader region to come into that facility, apply for employment, learn more about the job itself, fill out their application, go through an interview process, and potentially even have the first phase of background investigation completed. And so that instead of it taking, in some cases, several months, to bring somebody on, that we could have somebody have a conditional offer for employment potentially within days. And then once the conditions have been met, we could bring them in to a facility-based training experience that ultimately we believe connects them, gives them that necessary experience even before they start the academy in some instances, so they're not waiting 6 weeks or whatever it may be to get into that academy. We think expediting this process will go a long way, but it's going to require the totality of approaches in order to make this successful.
Representative Zerwas, would you have a follow-up by any chance?
A few. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I love the approach. I love the change in the approach, the expediency, and in this job market, you're right. Competitors are offering jobs at a much quicker rate than DOC was previously able to compete with. But what are the actual openings that have been kind of out there? Today we're talking about bringing on an additional 120 officers, and I guess my point is we can talk about raising the authorized amount till we're blue in the face. We're already sitting on dozens and dozens and dozens of CO positions that you just can't hire for.
Right. Representative Rosas, you're right. We would need to, over the course of the remainder of this biennium into the through the next, hire 200 correctional officers. And the only way that we could do that realistically was to begin to change some of our processes, and we believe the plan we have will help do that. We are going to begin to reach out more heavily with the schools, the colleges. Representative O'Neill talked about that this morning. We're really working to diversify our correctional officer workforce, and we believe, much like reaching out to the kids who may benefit from visiting their parents, we have to be more high touch today in order to bring people in the door, and I think that's our plan, that's the strategy to accomplish that goal.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
I'm wondering, Commissioner, if off the top of your head or with a phone a friend, you can tell the committee for a line officer, how many years it takes to get to the top correctional officer pay scale? Because when I found out about this, I was pretty stunned.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, I've heard a lot about this in my visits. I'll be the first to tell you the exact number of years I can't say, but it many people talked about it could take more than a decade to
12.
To get to top of scale. And again, this becomes, I think, one of the important considerations that obviously is a subject of to some level of collective bargaining. But ultimately, one of the things that happened in my previous work in law enforcement, one of the ways we managed retention of people was to try and shorten the scale to bring people up to the top quicker.
And, Mr. Chair, that's kind of my point. I think the commissioner alluded to it. And my next question was going to be, in your previous line of work, what was the longest that any of your police officers had to get to top patrol? I've never heard of a department over 7 years. Most nowadays are 5 years to get to top patrol. The idea that our corrections officers are in position for over a decade, I've heard 12 or 13 years to get to the top of the pay scale. What that ends up creating is it creates corrections officers that are in for 3 or 5 years of training that the state pays for to get pulled out to a county jail at still about a $5 to $7 an hour raise on day one. We train them, we get them experience, we get them ready, and the county jails take them because our scale is so long to get them to the top. Who's going to sit in the same position for 12 years to get to the top of the pay scale? That's not realistic. And so we can budget money to hire another 120 correctional officers, and if we factor in the number of openings that we have currently, as the commissioner said, that means we have to hire 200 officers to hit that mark. Even if we do that, if we don't address this pay scale, we're not going to keep them. One last question, if you'll indulge me. Mr. Commissioner, what's your retention rate of COs?
So we have done some looking at a retention. So I'll give you just a little bit of an example. Of the correctional officers hired in calendar year 18, 78% of those were still employed on January 24th of 19. Now, again, this is a little bit shorter period of time. And ultimately, when we begin to think about this, that about 78%, we're losing somewhere around between 20 and 25% of the people that we're hiring. And I think, you know, just well, this was eye-opening for me. In the first half of this fiscal year, 7/1/18 to 12/31, 151 COOs were hired. That's a lot of hiring. But to your point, we know that one of our challenges is that we oftentimes lose many of these people either very early on, or I think we too are concerned about losing that 2-year or 3-year officer who we've made an investment in. Obviously one of the things that we need to do is address this to make this a job that is competitive throughout the market, and I think really reflects the importance of the work.
Yeah, Representative Rose, while I share your passion, and I'm not normally one for a lot of protocol, let's try to get back.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the last thing I would say is the numbers that I saw at 5 years have a 5-year retention, a loss rate of nearly a third. And so we're investing a lot of money in training individuals that just flat aren't sticking around because their entry-level pay is not enough. But the idea that this pay scale is stretched out over 12 years, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And so unless there is a concerted effort moving forward by the Department of Corrections to address that portion of it, saying we're going to hire an additional 120 people doesn't much make sense.
And Representative Zerwas, again, appreciate your passion, and we are on the same page with that. But I will try to get things back on a little bit more of the correct protocol. I know I've not ever been one that's been terribly good about it. You have something else you want to add,
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner?
Just to Representative Zerwas's point, I do believe, I say this in all honesty, that I do believe that that we can make these hires. I think it's necessary for us to make them for the good and well-being of our facilities and for our staff. I do believe that you know, the department, we certainly would like to raise the pay of everyone. But I think ultimately we also are in a position where we have to honor the collective bargaining process and the agreements that get forged. And I think the attention that's been given to corrections by this committee and the attention in general, given the deaths of Officers Gum and Parisi, I think raise the specter of the importance of this as we go forward. And I think collectively there is a need to address this, but I do believe that we can get there.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Chair. Am I on here? Is it on? Okay. I have a question about programming. We haven't talked about that much. So where does funding for programming fall into all of this? And, you know, obviously there's going to be funding needs for the programming itself and then for the staff that you need for programming. So I know I've spoken quite a bit with the education folks in the Stillwater system, and they could sure use a lot of help, I think, too, in programming. So just curious where that falls into this whole pie chart that we have here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Christensen, thank you. I think one of the things that happens, one of the challenges that we face right now is, we've talked about before, nothing happens in a prison facility without security. We can't move people to programming. We believe that with adequate security staffing, we do have the ability to expand the capacity for people to access programming today, even educationally. We could grow the numbers of people that we provide educational services to. But in order for that to happen, we need to make sure that we bolster, in particular, in facilities like Stillwater, where there's adequate staffing to get the inmates to the programming and to provide supports to education staff or other program staff, treatment staff, as a for instance, while they're in those programs. So we do believe we have some capacity there to expand the number of inmates that can access those programs, but we need the security staff in order to do that safely.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of back to the retention issue. This was a conversation you and I had in my office, and I had a few corrections officers come in and kind of tell me their day-to-day life and how challenging it is. But one of the things that we talked about was management and leadership style. And it's something that we haven't talked about much in here, but it relates directly to retention. And since we do have a retention issue and it's going to be challenging to hire that many folks, can you just talk about your plan about helping the leaders and the management do a little bit better job and helping them to be more supportive, I think, of the corrections officers that they do supervise?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, yes, I think this is an area I think that we are giving significant emphasis to at the department. We've been just meeting with wardens and all the staff to talk about really what the importance, what the objectives are, and that is to ensure and work toward the success of all the people that we have contact with. And that's certainly the leadership objective standard that I want to apply to myself to ensure the success of others, as well throughout the ranks. And that becomes important. There's no doubt that the work of correction staff is exceedingly difficult. And I think that we're in an environment, and I saw some of this in my previous life in law enforcement, where there was the need to, one, have really high standards for the people who do this work, and at the same time to ensure that we're providing equally high levels of support, encouragement, seeing and having to deal with the things that correctional staff across the board, our nurses, our treatment staff, our case managers, our COs, deal with on a day-to-day basis is really tough. And I think one of the things that we are exploring and have been working with the collective bargaining units on is addressing some of the needs of people from this, just from the standpoint of officer and staff wellness. And this is an area that we have to do better because I think it is part and parcel to retention. And so it's a comprehensive package in terms of what we expect of leadership and the way we look at leadership within the Department of Corrections. But it also is being very concrete about the fact that this is tough work, and we don't want people taking this stuff home to their families because it can be tough enough without bringing it home to them.
Thank you, Commissioner. Do you have another follow-up?
Just one last small little question, just 30 seconds.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the last question is just about the opioid prevention. And you're going to be using money from the opioid stewardship fund if it's created. What are you going to do if it's not created?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, while certainly we would hope that there's a comprehensive approach to addressing the issues around opioid use, addiction, and all of the medical things that come as a result of it, what we will have to do is do the best we can. That with our existing medical staff, we will do everything we can to provide the necessary treatment services. But the reality is to meet the demands of the number of people that are coming into our facilities that are afflicted with this addiction, is a demand that I think will have implications in other areas of our medical and treatment care of people in our facilities. So I think it becomes incumbent upon us to think about the ways that we ultimately address the needs. Simply put, I think it's tragic to have people leave prison after whatever period of incarceration it is, and know that for some of these particular offenders, that they will die shortly after they're released without much needed intervention. And I think there's a moral obligation for us to provide services that we think will make a difference.
Just to follow up.
Promise. No. Representative O'Neill.
Just something that as we're doing budgeting, we're getting to the final nuts and bolts of things and into final negotiations, just something to think of as you're working on the budget, that if the stewardship fund doesn't go into effect for some reason as we're doing the last bit, that maybe you want to hold aside a few dollars just to help them out, because I think in the long run you're going to have a big impact.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill, and I think Chair Murray and I are both open up to that idea. And to your previous question, I'm going to be meeting with some custody officers next week to talk about some supports that we might institute. You're right, they need some more support on a regular basis, and we should be looking at giving that to them. I have one request, actually came from the audience. If somebody from your staff could tell me about programs for print disabled people and what opportunities there might be in higher education, and if they could get that to me, I would get it to the person that asked me. Are there any more questions or comments? Representative Zerwas, one more? No. Just pulling your leg. Okay. Okay. If that's okay. If that's it, then we're adjourned.